Seems a shame to have to introduce the jangle of noise, which is the marketplace, and the disharmony, which is international politics, into the beauty of song. But I suspect it tells us why melody and song are so central to the religious enterprise. They give to us some intimation of the order that lies behind all the visible disorder, of the beauty which our souls seek against the tawdriness of the everyday. And with that, dear friends, I have to turn to the Arab boycott and to the American reaction to it. The real world, to a world in which sinners are often the most powerful and callousness is often the rule of life. Let me begin by introducing you to a gentleman by the name of Sir Charles Cunningham Boycott. Captain Boycott was a retired officer of the English Army who, upon his retirement from the force, hired himself out as agent to the Duke of Erne, whose ancestral lands were in County Mayo in Ireland, sometime during the 1880s. The Earl of Erne is a British absentee landlord. It's a time of rising Irish nationalism. And at one point, late in the 1880s, the tenants of the Count's estates decide that they're not going to pay their rents and their tolls any longer. They'll determine what they should pay to this absentee colonial lord. And so they bring a token. And the Captain Boycott, refuses to accept it. And he's the visible presence of English misrule to these Irish peasants. Angry at his balking of their proposals, they escalate the pressures against him. And they adopt what is a new tactic in Irish nationalism. That is, they set up barricades along the road which lead to the estate, and they preclude any visitor from coming in or any goods from going out. Count Boycott is not able to go to the marketplace to buy the supplies he needs. He's not able to send out to the marketplace the harvest of the Count's estates. His servants are pressured to leave. He is cut off from the larger world. And this boycott, the word originates obviously from this incident, was reported in the London press at great length because it was the first instance of this attempt to use quarantine, economic and social quarantine, as a way of reducing the will of the colonials to maintain their power in some country, the will of some group to thwart those who were in power. And so the captain gave his name to history. And we refer to the attempts by the Arab states to thwart the economic growth of Israel, to undermine its economic strength, to quarantine Israel from the rest of the world as the Arab boycott. The Arab boycott actually began in 1936. Long before there was an Israeli state. In that year, the Arab League and the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who was then the spiritual leader of Palestinian Arabs and a good friend of Adolf Hitler, decided that they would bring added pressure against the English government to preclude further in-migration of Jews from Europe into Palestine. And they determined at the same time to take their vengeance on the unwanted Jewish intruders by instituting a boycott by requesting all of the Arabs of Palestine and of the surrounding countries not to do business with Jewish businesses, Zionist businesses, as they were called, and not to hire themselves out to Jewish manufacturers and farmers to help them in building up their resource or in putting out their manufactured item. Now, interestingly, as so often with an economic weapon, the results are paradoxical. And historians now believe that this first attempt at an Arab boycott of the Jews of Palestine was counterproductive. That is, it forced Jews to depend upon themselves, to return to some of the fundamental principles to which early Zionist philosophy had been dedicated. One of these was called Avodat Atzmit, which is essentially, we'll do our own work. We'll not be dependent upon anyone else. We'll not hire the Fellahin, we'll work the fields ourselves. And another was Totzeret Haaretz, that we will use our own manufactured produce, we will produce what we need, we will not be economically dependent on the Turks or on the British or on the Arabs, we will be as independent economically as we can. In the 1920s and 1930s, the pioneers had begun to hire Arab workmen for the field and to depend on Arab workmen in their factories. And the Arab boycott had the unexpected byproduct from the Arab point of view of increasing the economic viability and self-sufficiency of the Yishuv, which allowed it really to emerge as a self-sufficient state in 1948. So in a strange way, we have the Arab boycott to thank for some of the strength shown by the new Israeli state after independence. Very little was done in the way of boycott during the war years. But in 1945, at the end of the war, what we now call the confrontation states, the Arab states near Israel, decided to increase the activity of the boycott, which they did. General strikes against Jewish businesses, refusing to hire themselves out to work the kibbutz on the kibbutzim and the moshavot on the farms. An attempt to pressure other governments not to buy Jaffa oranges or other Israeli natural resources or manufactured items. And in 1951, after the establishment of the state, a central boycott office was established in Damascus to coordinate this basic boycott of the Israeli economy. Now, this boycott was to have two phases. Its first phase, which is called a primary boycott, was to preclude any Arab state from dealing in or trading with Israel. And the second concern of the boycott was to try and weaken the Israeli economy by quarantining it from all foreign trade. And to that purpose, in December of 1954, the Central Boycott Office published the first of a list of items. The list would later be much enlarged, which determined the requirements that businesses would have to meet in order to be able to trade with the Arab world. Failing to meet these requirements, these businesses would be blacklisted, and the countries involved could simply take this Central Boycott Office blacklist and declare to their, and publish to their chambers of commerce and industrial groups that they might not deal with the companies so named. Now, how did a company get onto the Arab boycott blacklist? Presumably, according to the rules set out in 1954, a company was registered on the blacklist if it had a branch manufacturing plant in Israel, if it had an assembly plant in Israel, if it entered into partnership in Israel with any Israeli commercial enterprise, if it lent technical or administrative skills to any Israeli company, if it entered into partnership with an Israeli company for some kind of undertaking anyplace else in the world, if it acted as the factor or agent for Israeli manufacturers to sell their products anyplace else in the world, if it acted as a major underwriter of bond issues of the Israeli government, And finally, if a company refused to fill out the forms which were demanded of it by the Central Boycott Office. Now, this last provision was in many ways the most pernicious, because the documents which could be requested might not only involve demands as to certificates of origin, that a particular manufactured item had not been, in fact, manufactured in the United States or in Japan, but had been manufactured, let's say, in Israel, which item would be boycotted. But it might include the demands that the company revealed that nowhere in the world was it dealing with any organization which had dealings with Israel. And it, in fact, often did demand the religion of the principals of the company and something about the charitable contributions of the principals of the company. An obvious move from being simply anti-Israeli to being anti-Jewish or anti-Semitic. The attempt to know about charitable concerns was obviously an attempt to know about involvement in the United Jewish Appeal and in activities of that kind. Now, in 1954, there was really very little trade between the United States and most of the countries of the West and the Arab world. The Arab bureaucracy was not well organized, and for a dozen years or so, the boycott sputtered along. It was erratically imposed. Some companies which had branch offices or branch manufacturing plants in Israel were not on the boycott list. Some companies were on the boycott list for reasons which no one ever understood. Some companies were put on the boycott list simply because the boycott office wanted to hold them up for blackmail. Here was a way of paying the freight, paying the cost of maintaining the office. But as the pace of trade with the Arab world increased, boycott activities became of greater concern to other companies and to the major industrial states in the world. In 1964, there was only about $200 million worth of export trade between the United States and the Arab world. But it was clear that figure was going to rise year by year. And the requests, the demands for boycott information that were coming down from the Arab world were more and more pushing American companies into the position where they were, in effect, acting as policemen, as administrators of the boycott itself. They were being asked information not only about their own trade with Israel, but they were being asked for information about the trade of their suppliers and of their agents and of their overseas subsidiaries. Banks were told that they would have to demand negative certificates of origin and other boycott compliance documents before they could process letters of credit. Insurance agents, freight groups and the like were told that they would have to provide certificates of origin and other boycott documents before they would be allowed to deal with the Arab states and Arab companies. And this was of great concern throughout the world, because now the Arab world was not only within its own frame trying to restrain the strengthening of the Israeli economy, but was trying to turn those companies which wanted to deal with it into agents who would use their own leverage to increase the pressure against Israel, to deny Israel trade, business opportunity, and the like. In 1965, the United States government was sufficiently concerned to add an amendment to the Export Administration Act, which is the act which governs our basic trade policy vis-a-vis export, which said, in effect, that the Department of Commerce should establish a monitoring agency. It required that businesses and contracting firms and the like, though not banks and other kinds of insurance organizations, would have to report to the Department of Commerce any requests which had been made of them for boycott information, and that the Department of Commerce would have to have this material available to the government when it wished to go through it. There were no sanctions imposed for compliance. In fact, it was not specifically said that compliance was against the law. The United States simply wanted to know what was happening to be able to determine whether or not the Arab boycott was having a negative effect on our trade and was intruding into the legitimate and purely legitimate domestic concerns of the United States. What's important about this first piece of so-called anti-boycott legislation is that included in this act, which was simply an act to survey the situation, was a clear statement of United States government policy, a statement which remains our policy to the moment. It is the policy of the United States, the act says, to oppose restrictive trade practices or boycotts fostered or imposed by foreign countries against other countries friendly to the United States, and to encourage and request domestic concerns engaged in the export of articles, materials, supplies, or information, to refuse to take any action, including the furnishing of information or the signing of agreements, which has the effect of furnishing or supporting restrictive trade practices or boycotts fostered or imposed by any foreign country against another country friendly to the United States. This was our stated policy. As the rate of trade, of export and import trade with the Arab countries increased, it increased to $1.8 billion by 1971, to $5.6 billion in 1975, to nearly $8 billion in 1976. The intrusion of the Arab boycott into the ordinary day-by-day practice of American business became more and more visible and of greater and greater concern. And more companies found themselves in the position of unilaterally or in compliance with a boycott, ruling out from bidding subcontractors and suppliers with whom they had long dealt, and of having to process for the Arab world demands for information which they would not normally give out in the course of their commercial undertakings, and more than this, being involved in what was potentially a series of anti-Semitic activities because a number of the countries, particularly Saudi Arabia and Libya, demanded baptismal certificates and other proof of religion of the principals of the companies involved and of those who were being sent by the companies to carry out contracting work, engineering work, or the like in their companies, in their countries. In 1975, the Ford administration was the first to take some kind of direct action to curb the intrusion of the Arab boycott into American industrial undertakings. President Ford, by executive action, ruled that no American company might supply to any foreign government information about the race, religion, nationality, sex, or other kinds of labels of this kind about its principals or employees, these items not being available normally within the course of business in the United States. And he ruled further that banks and insurance companies must now report to the Department of Commerce any requests that have been made of them to monitor the boycott for the Arab countries, to require certificates of origin and the like. And he further mandated that the materials which had been rather sloppily kept at the Department of Commerce should be more rigidly monitored and kept, and that when necessary, these materials should be available to those who are the representatives, the people, the Congress of the United States. He didn't go much further. Senator Ribicoff that year introduced an amendment to our tax laws which denied overseas tax credits of various kinds to companies which were, for one reason or another, in compliance with the Arab boycott activities. These rules did not penalize the large oil companies who were the major violators in this respect, because they were held to be totally owned tools or instruments of the countries in which they operated, and not, therefore not free to operate otherwise, an interesting statement about so-called American businesses. But more than this, they tended to operate against the large construction and engineering companies who were involved in Saudi Arabia and Libya, Egypt, places like that, and to penalize them for becoming agents, in effect, of Arab economic policies which were inimical to one of the stated policies of our national interest, that is, the economic viability and the survival and strength of the State of Israel. There was great hue and cry against this tax provision. A number of the companies did not comply. Finally, the Justice Department brought a suit against the Bechtel Corporation, the largest of the multinational construction companies in the world, one which is centered in the United States. And Bechtel Corporation was accused of requiring, of sending out to all of its agents throughout the world information requiring that they not buy materials, supplies from any company which was in the Arab blacklist, not only for their activities in the Arab world, but any place else in the world, in the United States or in Europe or in South America. And further, that it was requiring the same policy of all of its subcontractors and suppliers, that they not only be cleared from the Arab boycott list if they wanted to operate in the Arab world, but that they prove to the Bechtel Corporation that they had in fact not dealt with companies on the blacklist any place else in the world in the course of their normal business. In January of this year, a consent decree was entered into between the Justice Department and the Bechtel Corporation, in which they did not admit what was obviously the case, that they had engaged in such practices and agreed to cease and desist from them. And it's precisely this kind of activity that current anti-boycott legislation is designed to prevent and to preclude. The Ford administration then took the first steps towards curbing the impact of the Arab boycott within American industry, its impact setting up divisions between American businessmen and other American businessmen, between American businessmen who are not Jewish and those who are Jewish. But it was unwilling to go further. And when both in the Senate and in the House of Representatives, amendments were introduced to the Export Administration Act, which was up for renewal at the end of the last Congress in September of last year, and when some rather stiff provisions were entered into those amendments and passed by both houses, the Ford administration, under the pressure of large oil companies, mainly the large banks, some of American industry, brought sufficient pressure on the House committee, on the conference committee, to have the bill killed in conference, and no bill passed the last set in the 94th Congress. When this Congress came into being in January of this year, it was clear that it would have to be an Export Administration Act, and that some kind of boycott legislation would have to be part of that act, and that legislation now has been making its way through the Congress. It's very difficult legislation. It's difficult legislation because it requires the policing of all the industries of the United States, and as we know, American industry is both shy of giving out a great deal of information about its activities and quite willing, as we can see from the daily revelations in the American press, of doing all kinds of under-the-table things when in fact wants to do it. It's quite difficult then to find the ways of establishing a set of rules which would be effective, but in some ways it's more important that the record be clear and the purpose of the American government be clearly stated than it is to find a foolproof system of regulating anti-boycott legislation. It seems clear that the legislation which will pass this Congress, and some legislation will, that this legislation will preclude American businesses from revealing information as to the religion of its principals or employees. It seems clear that this legislation will, on the paper at least, tell American industry that it may not refuse to deal with Israel simply because it is selling to the Arab world and may not comply with boycott provisions in that respect. It seems clear that this provision will require the publishing of boycott requests received by the various companies and the opening to the public of the responses made by the various companies. It seems clear that there will be an attempt made to see that the certificates of origin which are required will stipulate simply that these goods are being manufactured in the United States. It will not be what they call a negative certificate of origin, which says that these goods are not manufactured in Israel. The attempt here is to take out the concern, which is really the larger concern on all of this, that American industry has been sensitized to Israel and sensitized to the Jews among them. They are now no longer operating in a religiously indifferent or Near Eastern indifferent praxis structure, and they must begin to consider whether or not they will deal and how they will deal with these complicated issues. And the problem here is not only will they comply with the boycott, but will they go beyond the boycott to avoid embarrassment? The one thing a lot of banks and a lot of insurance companies, a lot of the big businesses want is not to be put in the position where a great deal of static is raised upon their operation. So it's easier to not hire a Jew than to hire a Jew. So it becomes easier not to deal with Israel than to go out and seek trade with Israel. You're asking for trouble. Why bother? This is not to say that they do it. It is simply to say that this is inevitably the way they will look at the problems which come across their desk. And it's clear that to that extent, the Arab boycott has succeeded. I saw in some papers the other day the record of an engineer with 25 years of experience, a graduate of MIT who had worked with the major companies around the world, a Jewish engineer, who set out deliberately to be interviewed by the 8 major construction companies centered in the United States who do large amounts of business with the Arab world. He answered the ads which appeared in the New York Times on Sunday. When he wrote and sent in his resume, the 4 of the 6 companies that responded sent back a letter saying, "We've received your resume and it seems very appropriate to the job. We have several more questions we want to ask you. Question number 1, what is your religion?" Of the 2 companies which invited him in for an interview, 1 company asked right at the beginning of the interview, "What is your religion?" And when he told them, the interview was adjourned within 10 minutes. The last company involved interviewed him, failed to ask about his religion, offered him a job, and then 2 weeks later he was called up and told, from further investigation, we find we cannot offer this place to you. Now, this is one of the major concerns and one of the reasons the American Jewish community is so involved in this anti-boycott legislation, because it has intruded the factor of Jewishness into the capacity of young men and young women to advance within the business community and within the banking community and even within government itself. For I remind you that up till 3 years ago, up to an executive order of President Ford, the Corps of Engineers of the United States and the State Department of the United States refused to send employees, soldiers, who were Jews, to assignment in certain of the Arab countries. They were, in effect, carrying out the demands of the Arab companies by their own assignment policies. That's now prohibited under executive action, but it was effective policy. And one of our concerns is that many businesses will act ahead of time to make this possible. It would seem to me to be to the advantage of American businesses to have a very clear set of guidelines under which to operate. But one of the problems here is that no one else in the world wants to establish these guidelines. American business represents between 13 and 16% of the export business to the Arab world. None of the countries which govern the other 84-85% of that trade have any single law on their books which will require even the monitoring of requests for boycott information. None of the countries of the so-called free world, England, France, Germany, Canada, none of them have laws which preclude their companies from in any way doing anything that is necessary to comply with the boycott demands of the Arab countries. In this sense, we can be very proud of the United States that it's begun to move ahead. The question is, how far can it go and how far will it go? It's very clear that in an attempt to pull the teeth of much of this anti-boycott legislation, those businesses which have strong ties with the Arab world have begun to mount a major public relations and political pressure campaign, particularly in the journals and the newspapers which appeal to the world of industry. The reasons for this, well, there are many. Some of them are really captive of their single largest customer. Some of the companies have dealt so long in the Arab world that they can see only the Arab side of the coin. Some of the companies, in a sense, have tried to establish them in the Arab world by talking about their ability to make the American people, the American government, do it their way. Their good name, in that sense, is on the line. And the line that they have been trying to place before the American people is that if America passes strong anti-boycott legislation, we will stand to lose tens of thousands or perhaps hundreds of thousands of jobs. We will lose what little trade we now have with the Arab world, the 16%, and more importantly, in their fulsome concerns, America will lose its ability to move the Middle East towards peace because we will lose what leverage we now have with the Arab world as a country that they can depend upon and know to be fair-minded. When the legislation was before the last Congress, various departments of government were asked to estimate the loss of businesses that might accrue to the United States because of anti-boycott legislation. And though obviously no government agency in the United States can determine what will be the policy of the Arab states, that's erratic at best, the best answer that could be given to this question was that most of the business which we now do with the Arab world is highly technical in nature. And we are, in a sense, the only place in the world where these services and supplies are available. That though we might lose some business, it would not be of a great order. Whether we would lose some new business which might be available, no one could in fact say. But at the same time, it must be clear that we would not gain leverage with the Arab world to achieve peace, because all we would be telling the Arab world in effect was that we cannot stand up against them, that whatever they want, given their new oil dollar power, they will get. If we give in the boycott, we'll have to give in then on whatever we propose in Geneva. If we have given in what we propose in Geneva, we'll have to give in again further down the line. Leverage power is useful only when it can be used. And the fact that our tourists and our diplomats are now welcome at Riyadh or in Cairo or in Damascus is no proof that we in fact have leverage with these governments to encourage them to do what we want them to do or to accept a peace in the Middle East which seems reasonable to us. Not at all. What is a test here is a test of will. Whether in fact the Arab countries can dictate to the world, to the United States, how we will conduct our business, how we will manage our trade, what standards we will accept as appropriate standards between nations and as appropriate standards between commercial undertakings within the nations. Now, it's hard to know how all this will work out. I suspect it will work out as most things done, with partial solutions and partial answers and getting along. Israel has not been hurt particularly by the Arab boycott. Israel has found ways to make up within its own resources or from other sources what it could not get here or there when some company or some country boycotted trade with Israel. The real impact of the Arab boycott is internal and domestic. It has to do with the way in which business will be conducted here in the United States, whether religion will suddenly become an issue within the business world, whether the business world can be turned into a group who will police the boycott for the Arab states or not. There are obviously limits to how far the boycott can be allowed to intrude within our economy. What those limits are will be established by law and will be tested in the courts. Let's hope that they are strict and that American business shows a social concern beyond that which some of its parts have not shown heretofore. And for us as Jews, well, we're Jews. We've been here before. And for us as Jews, there's a concern here because what we're seeing in operation is the power of the weapon, which is the dollar, the power of oil, the power of commerce. It explains why we now are concerned about even, so-called even-handedness. What does it mean? How far will any government give in to the demands of those who have the dollars, whose dollars we want? Clearly, the nations of Western Europe have been unwilling even to face up to the possibility of establishing anti-boycott regulations. Canada may, but no other country has moved in that direction. Clearly, we're learning something about how the world really operates and what the diplomats really mean when they talk of peace and negotiations in Geneva. The problem at Geneva will not be whenever it meets Israel's intransigence. The question at Geneva will be how eager is the Western world to forget its principles and to get the dollar which is born out of the earth, out of the oil, under the Arab states. Amen.